Welcome to the Mike Fave Podcast. I'm your host, Ethan Wright, joined by Mike Fave. On this podcast, Mike and I help you make sense of the online health chaos while answering your individual health questions along the way. So if you have any health trends, topics, or questions you'd like to see us cover, please leave them in the comments below, and we'd be happy to get them answered on future episodes. In today's episode, we are going to dive into the carnivore diet and discuss the ways in which the carnivore diet can negatively impact your gut health and what you can do about it, what Dr. Ken Berry gets wrong about bowel movement frequency on the carnivore diet, the potential problem with Dr. Sean Baker's thoughts on GI issues during the carnivore diet, and lastly, the flaws in Dr. Jordan Peterson's perspectives on the risks of the carnivore diet. So to kick things off, let's start by sharing our personal experiences with the carnivore diet, which Mike and I both tried. So I know I have my reasons for why I jumped into the carnivore, but I'm curious to hear what the backstory was for you, Mike.
I think it's similar as for most people that you tend to go like low carb and then keto and then carnivore. So it's like this trajectory is you just like one, the next and the next and the next. And I actually started with intermittent fasting because I found Martin Birkin's lean gain stuff when I was in high school and I was working out and I was trying to, you know, he was basically saying like he's eating a whole cheesecake and then he's super lean and all type of stuff. So I was pretty interested in it based on that. It was like pretty exciting. It's like a new dietary strategy, different from what, you know, I had heard before because I was into all the bodybuilding stuff at that point. And then from intermittent fasting, I went right in to low carb and I guess like a keto-ish or paleo-ish approach. Then it went like full keto, and then it went like autoimmune paleo keto intermittent fasting, and then it went like autoimmune, and then it went like carnivore intermittent fasting and keto altogether. And that was like the final stage, like that was the final boss of the dietary sphere. So I got into it because I initially felt better when I had switched over to the IF and when I had switched over to lower carb eating. You get into this thought process, right? That it's the fibers, the problem, the FODMAPs are the problem. It's the plant toxins, it's the lectin, it's the oxalates, it's the phytic acid, all this type of stuff. Up until I got into the carnivore stuff, which didn't last very long for me, and I'll talk about why, but I basically was still doing greens for a while because the only way I could get potassium and calcium and components like this, because I wasn't tolerating dairy at all. So I was doing the keto, autoimmune, paleo, intermittent fasting setup. And I was basically just doing that with like meat, seafood, eggs, greens. And then from there, I transitioned all the way into carnivore with intermittent fasting and basically keto to some extent. There's a couple things in there we'll talk about along the way that got a little adjusted. But yeah, for me, it was like I went low carb, I started feeling better, and then I just went straight down the rabbit hole until I made my way to carnivore.
Yeah. And then with the carnivore, did you get benefits digestively from it?
Carnivore was a mixed bag. I would say the biggest noticeable benefits I got digestively were when I first went low carb. Well, every time I eat white rice, I go into a food coma. So like I digest the white rice, but then it affects my cognitive function. And so I'm just like, I can't really do too much white rice. And then I was like, okay, what if I do all fruits and vegetables as my carb sources? Because I found that they didn't make me sleepy. You know, the first thing that I did was apples and pears, which is like a hard no, because the very high, like imbalanced glucose to fructose ratio, high in FODMAPs. And so I felt better, but I was then bloated and gassy and stuff like this. Whereas the rice, I wasn't bloated and gassy. I was just, I was just sleepy. So then I basically was like, okay, well, maybe if I just do all like low carb, like no carbs at all. And I started doing butter and beef tallow and egg yolks and olive oil. And then I wasn't getting sleepy and I wasn't getting bloated. And so that was a huge change for me. I felt significantly better. While I wasn't trying to do this, I got exceptionally lean. Like there's a whole timeline in there. I don't want to go through the whole thing, but the first thing is when I came into low carb, I felt better. And then I ran into some issues. Like I was getting cold, very like pretty frequently cold, and I was having some cravings, and my workout performance wasn't as good and stuff like this. And then so I kept going down the rabbit hole. So I was like looking for answers. And I think a lot of people do this as well. Looking like, what's going to be the best thing? What's going to be the next thing? And so I like doubled down multiple times on it's the fibers. It's the carbohydrate. I need to get less and less and less and less. I need more fat. I need more protein, whatever the deal was. And when I got to carnivore, I started having like straight diarrhea every day, tons of like bile acid problems. I didn't have a gallbladder at this point. And then I was just like cold hands and cold feet. Like severely cold hands and cold feet. My mood was like super labile all over the place. My libido like just went completely into the toilet on carnivore after a while. So I realized that, okay, like that like I didn't stay that long because it only took a couple months for me to really have a problem. And then I had switched out. Like the low carb was a boon for my digestion and cognition. And then carnivore kind of like, I took it all the way to that level, but it didn't necessarily create the benefit I was looking for.
I feel like that's the similar trajectory we see most people go on, is starting with the low carb and keto, and then you move all the way over to carnivore when you're kind of experiencing the problems with the keto. That's how it was for me, at least. And then I just wasn't even physically able to stay like carnivore for that long. I mean, it was maybe 4 to 6 months. I was losing weight like so rapidly that people like around me, I think were a little concerned, like my roommates and stuff. What really put the nail in the coffin for me in carnivore was the last week of college, we had to move out of the apartment and I needed to like clean everything and whatever. And I was going to help my roommates, but I was eating raw beef liver and I got some sort of infection or food poisoning or something from the raw beef liver in like the days leading up to us having to clean the apartment and everything. And it just, I couldn't help whatsoever. I was just like incapacitated. So I still feel bad about that. But that was really when I was like, you know what, I'm done with this. Like I got to start looking at other ways. But yeah, that was kind of my experience. Like I feel like a lot of people too do find the carnivore stuff does become unsustainable at a certain point.
It could be even part of our confirmation bias because we see so many people trying to transition out of carnivore. I think there's perhaps a portion of people who do well with it for some particular reason, maybe digestively or they like it, they can kind of tolerate it. But I see a lot of people, I think it winds up becoming unsustainable for a variety of reasons. Well, we're going to talk about that here today, specifically the digestive components. It's not that carnivore, at least from my perspective, doesn't give people benefits. And like same thing with low carb. Like as I mentioned, there is some downsides to carnivore dieting in general, even though there is some benefits. And I think that there is a way to minimize the downsides with the diet while maximizing the benefits without, and basically means like not being potentially not being full carnivore, maybe doing some other components or adding some other components into the diet that is animal based. And I think there's also a variety of people who are getting benefits from the diet for different reasons. So if you are a vegan and say you have a bunch of, I don't know, genetic predispositions for issues with MTHFR or choline synthesis or something like this, and you're a vegan, well, you're going to have problems for coming out of the vegan diet. And you go on carnivore and you start smashing high choline foods. You start bumping up animal-based folate intakes. You start increasing B12 intakes. And it's like, wow, I feel so much better. And it's not necessarily because there's magic to not having any plant foods. It's that you may have had specific deficiencies in a particular area that you just corrected. If you have dysbiosis in the colon, like for example, like Michaela Peterson, and then all of a sudden you don't feed it with these like grain-based starches and things like this that are a problem, yeah, you're going to feel better. And say your diet was crap before, if you had a bunch of micronutrient deficiencies and you come to an animal-based diet that's super nutrient dense now compared to what you're doing, like you will feel better. And if you're avoiding a bunch of problematic components going to colon, you will feel better. And if you have metabolic dysfunction, all of a sudden you have high satiety with a high protein intake and you lose weight, you will feel better. But it doesn't mean that there still aren't downsides to that diet. So we're going to talk about some of the big ones today.
There are people who maybe had some success accomplishing whatever their goals were when they initially came into carnivore, whether it was weight loss or an autoimmune disease or gut issues, whatever the case may be. But now that they've kind of gone to a certain place, they want to start adding things back in. They run into problems when they try to add back things in for a variety of reasons that we'll discuss. So hopefully like later on in this podcast, we'll talk about maybe some of the more systematic and intelligent ways to add the foods back in to provide some context for everybody. For one of the things you hear in the carnivore sphere in general is around like a frequency of bowel movement. So some people find when they come to carnivore, they stop having as many bowel movements. And what you can hear from the carnivore proponents, and we'll hear from Ken Berry, is that that's because your body is becoming so efficient at absorbing nutrients and everything that you're putting in it, that there's just zero waste. And it's suggesting that everything that was, you know, coming out before was just all sort of a waste product. And one thing I want to highlight was on Twitter, for the bioenergetic people on Twitter, you may find this interesting, but there was a back and forth between Danny Roddy and Ken Berry. If you're deep into various health rabbit holes, but lack 3 solid, easy to pass bowel movements daily, simplify and focus on that. And then as you can see underneath, Ken Berry responds with a LOL. If that may give you an idea where Ken Berry stands on that take, but just to provide some more context, we'll jump into this clip from Ken Berry and then get your thoughts afterwards.
Now, when you're eating purely a carnivore diet, this freaks a lot of people out. They're like, oh, pooping every fifth day, that could not be healthy. All that meat's just sitting there rotting in your colon. Now, what happens is meat is pure nutrition. There's no garbage that you have to poop out. You absorb every bit of the meat. So for a carnivore, all they're pooping out is dead bacteria that die by the billions every day in your large intestine and dead epithelial cells that have sloughed off somewhere along the gastrointestinal tract. There's no waste in a carnivore diet. Very, very little waste. And so that's all you're pooping out tomorrow. So every fifth day is completely and totally fine.
Oh, boy.
I don't know what your thoughts are around the frequency of bowel movements in that take, but I'm very interested to see.
We actually just had a question in the Revive community about this yesterday. And the question is like, what's the optimal number of bowel movements per day? I'd say at least one bowel movement per day would be what we'd be shooting for, up to like, you know, one bowel movement after each meal. And then on the Bristol stool chart, anywhere from like a 3 to maybe a 5 would be considered normal. And then 1 and 2 would be more constipation. And then a 6 and 7 would be considered more diarrhea. So, or like loose stools. And both those are, one is the food is transiting the diarrhea, or loose stools would be food transiting too fast through the colon. And then you're not absorbing the water. And then on the flip side, a 1 or 2 is that food is not transiting that fast at all. And it's backing up. And then it's like really dry, you know, really dry, and all the water is being absorbed out. And so you kind of want somewhere in the middle. And that's at least one bowel movement per day, up to like 1 after each meal, or like, you know, up to 3 bowel movements per day would be, I think, what I would personally recommend shooting for. Now, there's a variety of reasons why you could have either slow or super fast. For me with carnivore, it was like, especially because I don't have a gallbladder, but I was having a terrible time with carnivore. Now, part of that, to be fair, is because I don't have a gallbladder, which is a specific situation. But I've also seen other people have this same circumstance. I think for you is relatively similar, right? Ethan, you're like running to the bathroom with a carnivore setup. But then you also have, on the flip side, where what Dr. Ken Berry is saying is where you have like a bowel movement once every fifth day or seventh day. So I've also had clients who come from that with carnivore diet. Now, there's some problems with what he's saying. First things first, there is waste on a carnivore diet. So the research is pretty clear that the carnivore diet, only about 95% of protein and only about 95% of bile acids are absorbed. And they say even 80% of protein is absorbed, and depends on the protein, but animal protein is more absorbable. So we'll say up to 90-95%. So while you do have less waste going into the colon, less waste, we'll say that in air quotes here, going into the colon during carnivore, you still have protein, bile acids, potentially some fats, and then things like heme iron making it to the colon on a carnivore diet. And this is really not a good thing. Like this is potentially why bowel movements are so slow, because one, you have less waste, but some of these components are pretty irritating and problematic for the colon and for the microbiome, and that could be slowing transit time down, as well as having like the minimal waste as well. So the other thing I want to frame this here with is it's actually not a good thing to not have the fiber, what you'd say waste, be transiting through the digestive tract for a variety of reasons. The major ones being the fiber binds up the bile acids and proteins and heme iron in the colon and protects the colon from those components because they're extremely irritating to the colon. We'll talk about that in just a second. And then the fiber also helps to detoxify components from the body by binding to those bile acids and pulling it out, and the liver is secreting toxins into the bile. So basically we have a quote here, and what they say dietary fiber can increase stool volume and decrease stool transit time, thus diluting the concentration of carcinogens in the colon and reducing the time of intestinal exposure to carcinogens. So this is super important, because basically what you're seeing is the fiber, which Dr. Berry is saying is more waste, actually helps to, even though it's technically waste, we're not absorbing it, it actually helps to decrease the amount of time that things transit through the colon. So you're having less of these metabolites, these waste products, sit inside the colon. And then it also is diluting them so that they're not directly interacting with the colon, so you don't have irritation, and overall reducing the exposure of the colonic epithelium to the heme iron, the protein, the bile acids, fatty acids, things like this. They further go on to say indeed, dietary fiber binds bile acids and alters the enterohepatic axis, which can reduce cholesterol levels involved in the etiology of colon cancer. In contrast, secondary bile acids produced by bile acid metabolism are thought to be promoters of colorectal cancer, which can cause significant damage to the colonic mucosa, such as oxidative stress and inflammation. Dietary fibers broken down by intestinal flora into short-chain fatty acids, such as acetate, propionate, butyrate, which can decrease intestinal luminal pH, which helps reduce the conversion of protobile acids to carcinogenic secondary bile acids. So basically what you're seeing here is, again, the fiber helps to actually, this increased waste helps to protect the colon from some of the toxic components that the carnivore diet, even as less waste, is allowing them to sit in the colon for a longer period of time and create more toxic components and we're going to get into this in specific detail in just a second, and create more irritation to the colon and more potential problems inside the colon. So even though you have less waste, it's sitting there longer, it's producing more toxic metabolites, and it's having more exposure to the colon than if you had fiber and you had a faster transit time. So the idea of like it's less waste or more waste actually is irrelevant here. The fundamental question is like, what is that waste that's being produced, which there is a percentage of waste being produced on a carnivore diet, actually doing to the colon? And it's not great things. And I'm going to explain why in just a second.
So one of the big things for me when I started like watching your content and everything like that was on your MyFave Science channel, you break down the study that's kind of outlining this stuff. And I know you've worked with a lot of carnivores as well, and me included, like coming out of that space, when you try to tolerate different sources of fiber and stuff like that, you may find that you're reacting to more things than you were before, correct? At least that's my experience for me. And I think what you're describing there is that, yes, when you're on the carnivore diet, like if someone is experiencing alleviation from symptoms, it could be because the food isn't making it, there is no waste, right? So there's nothing for the bacteria to get a hold of in the colon. But then when you
significantly less waste,
but you are kind of creating an environment potentially that could, that when you do try to feed yourself like different fibers and foods and everything, that now you've set up sort of a bad ecosystem there, right? That's the idea.
Yeah. So I guess that's good for the overarching picture. So basically what happens is, if you have problems in the colon, you have dysbiosis, the ecosystem, the bacterial ecosystem or microbial ecosystem is off. When you throw fiber in there, then you, like, depending on the type of fiber and depending on how much, you don't know what's going to ferment what metabolites are going to be produced. And so you can get bloating, you can get gas, you can get like different types of rashes or things like this. And so when you go on a carnivore diet or a low carb diet, you minimize the amount of fermentable substrate going to the colon. So you oftentimes will feel better because you're not bloated, you're not gassy. There's also other benefits with the diets. You increase nutrient density a lot of times, depending on which dietary background you're coming from. You also can improve the amount of proteins you're having. You're shifting fatty acids. You're minimizing additives in the foods that would be irritating, like gums and stuff like this, because there's no gums in steaks, at least not right now. And so basically what winds up happening is you eliminate a lot of problems. But the problem is like now that you don't have any fibers at all, and then you're just dumping protein or amino acids and your peptides and bile acids and fats into the colon, and also heme iron, all of these components can start to really irritate the intestine over time and do things like deplete the mucus layer and change the colonic microenvironment so that there's more oxygen present, which will shift the microbiome. And so all of these things, while you feel better initially and for a while you limit some of these other problematic components, you start to create new problems because you don't have fibers present. So it's not that all fiber is bad. It's not that all carbs are bad. It's that like black beans versus something like a banana may have a massive, like a ripe banana may have a massively different effect inside your microbiome because of the different fibers and components present inside these different foods. And so you have to figure out which carb source you're going to tolerate. Carnivore just like nukes everything out. And so it's like, yeah, I'm only going to eat meat. I'm only going to eat animal foods. I'm going to have two ribeyes and salt, bro. Whatever the thing is, like, you're just going to get get rid of all the potential problems, but not everything could have been a problem. And then again, doing that also creates new problems.
Right.
The new problems are from these specific mechanisms. It's from the bile acids, it's from the heme iron, it's from protein getting into the colon, it's from the lack of fiber, which leads to a lack of short chain fatty acid production, which changes the metabolism of the colonocytes. And then that's when you come to the back end of carnivore, you're like, oh crap, I can't eat a single thing. Like, there is a risk to doing this diet, even if it does fix some things and eliminate some problems. That's what we need to be aware of, the pros versus cons when you first start.
There's less waste, but there is a certain amount of waste. And we can see that in the research. And in particular, that waste can cause long-term problems.
Is like super irritating to the colon.
Right.
And then the lack of certain components plus the irritation from that waste damages the colon over time and lead to long-term problems.
And I remember watching your video breaking down the study and you mentioning the different compounds that help with that. and some of them being polyphenols, right? Which don't necessarily have to come from high fiber foods, right? So for example, like I think you mentioned like tannins and like pomegranate juice potentially, or grape juice or something like that, as having a beneficial effect. And that's a food that doesn't have any fiber, right? So if you are reacting to fiber and you're deciding to add back in carbohydrates, like you can do it in a stepwise fashion. And would it be maybe ideal to start more so on the lines of something like a juice that has some of these protective compounds, and then go to fibrous foods and whatnot?
Yes, because the problem is like there's multiple issues going on with a carnivore diet. So while we're talking specifically about the microbiome, you also have the metabolic problems as well. And then you have micronutrient problems that develop on the diet because you're so limited in your food choices. And so when you're transitioning, like you don't only have to transition your gut, you have to transition your metabolism, you have to transition your hormones, and you also have to fix some of the micronutrient problems that you develop inside these diets. And so there's like so many things happening at once besides like, I'm just adding in carbs. So that's why people, like when they're transitioning out of carnivore, they're like, oh, well, my sleep's better, my energy's better, but I'm like, my digestion is like, I don't know what is going on with my digestion since I'm trying to eat foods that like 6 months ago I had no problem eating, and now I can't eat them at all after this carnivore diet. And it's because of this effect, like this depleting of the mucus layer and all these changes, which again, we can get into them like sequentially so that is clear, but it's because of those effects with the gut. And that's the gut is the hardest part to transition.
That's a good disclaimer to put, is like before you consider the carbohydrate, like we've talked about in previous videos, you have to take into consideration the metabolic side of things too. And then hopefully like as you add in the juices and you start to the polyphenols and the other compounds that are helping to curate the microbiome there, you can start to create a better ecosystem to there. Like your tolerance can just hopefully increase, you know, over time, like as everything starts to shift. Cause I think the microbiome, it has a pretty like rapid adjustment to the diet, right? Like that is the biggest lever to pull, as opposed like first before you start going down the other gut modulatory protocols and everything.
Yeah. And it depends on the person. Like if you went into the carnivore diet and your gut was already wrecked, and then you try to, then you like use it as a way to manage gut symptoms, and then you come out, you may have a harder time than somebody who just went on a carnivore diet to lose weight and then like develop gut issues after, because your gut was already unstable to some extent, and then you potentially worsened it with carnivore, even though symptomatically some things got better. And then when you come out of it, like trying to add things back in can be a really difficult time. On average, the vast majority of people like wind up developing worse gut symptoms when they try to come out of carnivore, even though it fixes some other problems. Like it does fix some other problems for people. So I don't want to gaslight anybody and say like it doesn't work, because it does, but it creates new problems. And you have to be aware of these, especially if you're looking to transition out.
And the other thing I just want to mention, like real quick, when I was going back and watching your video on the study breakdown that I thought was really interesting, was the difference in the polyphenols that intake from like the US versus Spain, or I think it was Spain, right? It was like 450 times like the amount. And then I think you cited in there, like maybe that's some of the benefits that people see from like the Mediterranean diet, right? That's studied for longevity and things like this.
Yeah. I think the polyphenol compounds in general are beneficial. Like overall, I'd say that they're pretty beneficial. And I think largely their benefit is through modulating the gut. It's not even through really absorbing them that much. It's through their shift inside the microbiome. And then like that lowering a variety of toxic metabolites coming out of the colon. And then it's like, okay, yeah, like you will feel better when you decrease that overall. As you start to add in more foods like this, the microbiome ecosystem starts to shift and you have all this cross-feeding going on. So like this bacteria, like Bifidobacterium breve, will produce this metabolite. And then you'll have like Fecalobacterium prasnuti produce this metabolite. And then you'll have like Akkermansia will take that and make this metabolite. And so they're cross-feeding. So when you start adding in basic stuff, kind of like when a baby comes off breastfeeding, it starts to slowly expand the ecosystem, and then you start to tolerate more things because you have a whole bunch of bacterial populations that are breaking down, and you shift away from the toxic endotoxin bacteria that are producing a bunch of negative metabolites. And then you can also start to increase butyrate production in the colon, which the colon cells then suck the oxygen out of the gut, and that shifts the microbiome. But this takes time. Like it doesn't just happen like this. It's like a progressive thing. And each step that you take, you're not going to immediately be like, oh yeah, I feel 100 times better GI wise. It's like, maybe it's going to be a 6 or 7 out of 10 on the white rice for the first couple of days. And then after that, it's like, okay, I feel like this is fine. Like I actually feel better and I'm not really having as much digestive issues. So sometimes you have to give it a little bit, push through, let the gut adapt, and then you start to go to the next food. So it's best to do it systematically, But most people, they get carbs again after being carnivore and keto for however long. And like Pandora's box is open, and it's just like all the carbohydrates that they can have, because their body has also been like, to some extent, like in a starvation mode for so long.
That reminds me. I mean, I talked to somebody the other day who was just coming out of carnivore, like within a few days, right? And then he booked the call with me, and we're talking about the symptoms he's experiencing on carnivore. And he's telling me, yeah, I just started adding back in carbs. He's like, I had a glass of milk last night. Bad idea. Like really bad idea. And then I'm thinking, okay, this is good though, because we're at like, you haven't gone full bore into like, I'm adding in every carbohydrate, like all at once, which I think was the trajectory that he was going to head down. I'm like, okay, this is perfect. We can take a deep breath and we can start to do some of the things like intelligently, that we caught you at this moment. Cause there's a lot of people that, that go the opposite route, and they just jump right into things like you're saying. And then another thing I wanted to bring up too, just in regards to like practicality and what you can do. Like when we started working together, one of the cool things I started doing as per your recommendation was to cut the different juices in different amounts. So like a pomegranate juice, for example, is like really like trying to drink 16 ounces of pomegranate juice is one, super expensive, and two, like really strong, like hard to get down. But if you cut pomegranate juice, like 2 ounces or 4 ounces with 8 ounces of pineapple or orange or something like that, it's delicious. Plus you get the benefits of more polyphenols, right? To potentially help modulate things there. And the other thing that we did, per your advice, was to add maybe some of the fruit powder extracts. Like an elderberry powder was something that you had cited in that study as being protective against the sulfur producing bacteria. So if you do like 2 ounces of pomegranate juice, 8 ounces of pineapple juice, a little bit of like elderberry fruit extract powder or acerola powder extract, and you mix it into the juices, now you have like not only a carbohydrate source, but you have like this sort of superpower polyphenolic like drink. And then maybe you have just a small little thing of blueberries as well for the anthocyanidins, which you also cited in that study as being a good curator of the microbiome. And maybe you don't go overboard on it right away, because that could be like an abundance of fiber and there's the skins and everything like that. But now you have a setup there that you can pair with your giant ribeye that's going to protect against the waste, you know, that is in the colon. So those are some like really good strategies that I know that you use with the people, your clients and whatnot, that you use for me, that made a big difference. So maybe people give that one a try.
The goal in that circumstance is to slowly bump up polyphenolic intake with the juices and like the different sources, so that you can essentially start to slowly shift the microbiome before you try to run a gut protocol or anything like this. So, but the caveat there is just if you have like diabetes or like blood glucose stuff, you got to be careful with the juices. And that's where it's like, maybe you want to try a little bit more whole fruit. So it's really a person to person dynamic. Like when I'm working with somebody, like, and they come in, I'm going to gauge, do they have metabolic dysfunction? Is it mostly a gut problem? Is it a combination of both? And I'm going to try to adjust from those different dynamics. Like if it's somebody who just has a gut problem, maybe I'll start with juices and the powders. And if it's somebody who's metabolic dysfunction, maybe I'll do like whole fruits, or if they do better with starches, the starches, and then run from there and start to slowly expand the diet first, and also correct micronutrients. Because the intestine is very, very metabolic, or it has a high metabolic activity, one of the highest in the body. It's like the central nervous system and GI tract are two, have like, take most of the caloric intake of the body, or some of the largest sources of energy requirements. And so they also have huge requirements for micronutrients. And so if you run carnivore, there's some micronutrients that you can cause problems with. And a lot of times repleting those micronutrients can make a massive difference in intestinal function. And so I usually correct that, change up the diet, do like, I call the polyphenolic stuff like the chronic gut stack, because you can just do that perpetually. Like you do blueberries, you could do elderberry, you could do pomegranate extract, you could do acerola, camu. You tolerate those things, like you can just perpetually do them. It's not going to be a huge issue. The gut protocol stuff, which is separate, like that's like down the road, that is like an acute thing to do. And I only do that for a short period of time to try to clear the gut out if the person's still having a problem. So that would be like some of the steps to come out, to like move through. And then also another thing that we did that was helpful, which may seem like heresy to some of the bioenergetic crowd and to some of the carnivore crowd, but we also switched the meat source. So that there's seafood and that there's chicken, like chicken breast and even chicken thigh, like 4 ounces of chicken thigh is not really that big of a deal in terms of polyunsaturated fat intake. But we switched it because heme iron is one of the big things that can really irritate the colon, like terribly. And if you're on a carnivore diet and you're just like the heme iron, the absorption of heme iron is only like 25 to 30%. And that's from organ meat, which would be like the best source of heme iron. So you have the rest of the heme iron is going to be left into the colon. And the heme iron causes oxidative stress and causes irritation to the colon. And is like a that's why red meat is classified as a carcinogen, because the heme iron goes in and irritates the colonic epithelium. So if you're coming, it's not that you never eat red meat again, but it's that if you're doing tons of red meat and your colon is super irritated and the microbiome is really shifted in a bad way, what you want to do is you want to maybe shift towards some of these other protein sources, whey, chicken, seafood options, cod, sole, flounder, shrimp, stuff like this, so that you're not continuing that irritation process. You let it heal. And then once things get back under control, then you start having some, you know, have a ribeye for dinner again, whatever the deal is. But it's just in the meantime, when it's irritated, you want to remove some of the potential irritating triggers. And then you can bring them back in once the gut is okay. Like if you're putting like lotion on your skin and your skin is completely fine, like it doesn't have any problems. And it's okay, fine, like I'll put this lotion on, right? It's good for my skin. It has like vitamins and cocoa butter or whatever. But say you had a cut, you wouldn't like start rubbing that lotion in the cut, even though the lotion is technically good for your skin. You would let the cut heal and then you put it back on after it's like kind of healed up. So you're not like it's not stinging and burning the area. And it's kind of the same thing with the colon. Like if you have a bunch of irritation in the colon, you want to minimize any possible irritants just for a period of time so your gut can recover. And it, to be fair, may not be the problem, but it's like a potential. And like for me, that was one, like I was realizing like every time I was having red meat, like the left lower quadrant pain I was having was worse. And so I was like, all right, what if I do chicken? And it's like, oh, well, I actually feel significantly better with the chicken. And then that's when I was like, okay, maybe the heme iron of the red meat does cause some irritation to somebody who's already having irritation.
And another point that I've heard you make too in regards to the heme iron, and this is just a testament to the plant compounds being protective, is that doesn't the chlorophyll like block some of the effects of heme iron in the gut?
Yes, chlorophyll and calcium.
And calcium, okay. So like if you do decide that I'm going to start, if you go switch to chicken and fish and whey and all this, and then you decide you want to come back to having the ribeye, you know, a couple times a week or for one meal or something like that, you have this strategy where you're like, I know when I do that, I'm going to, you know, eat something with chlorophyll or whatever, some plant,
like
right?
Green beans or peas, something that doesn't bother you.
And then I think what you mentioned there at the end with the fats and getting the pain in the lower left quadrant is a pretty good transition into our next clip that we hear, that we have here from Sean Baker. So I know carnivores, and I think people in general, one of the macronutrients that trip them up and give them some of the most trouble with digestion is fat. For me, I think for you probably as well. And figuring out that situation with the fats can really make a difference. And there are some things on carnivore with a high saturated fat intake that in talking to people that they don't really think about that potentially being a problem. So I think we can jump into the clip from Sean Baker and then sort of like get your thoughts after that around the fats and digestion and everything.
All right, let's talk a little bit about gut issues on carnivore diet. The most common reason I see people still continue to have gut issues on a carnivore diet are primarily fat consumption. And it's usually excessive fat consumption relative to what you can safely or naturally absorb. And so that often comes more often in the context of rendered fat. Rendered fats would be things like grease, bacon grease, hamburger grease, concentrated fats like butters and creams. Those often overwhelm our capacity to absorb them. Remember, our digestive system is not designed to digest concentrated nutrients, whether that be powdered flour, powdered sugar, protein powders, concentrated fats and oils. That's not what we're designed to do. Now we can to a capacity handle those things, but it's not optimal or ideal. And so if you're having a lot of reflux, bloating, gas, diarrhea, look at the amount of fat you're eating per meal, and perhaps you might want to cut that back.
The nice thing about these clips is like just had Dr. Ken Berry talking about people having transit time of like 5 days, which is insane. And it's a difficult spot to put people in with this clip, like with this setup. Because if you don't eat fat on this diet, what do you eat? You just eat protein. There's nothing left to eat. And we're talking about like you actually have to eat a ridiculous amount of fat on this diet if you're going to make it work, because you don't have any carbs, or else you're going to cause significant problems. So there's like, I don't know, like it's like a straitjacket. It's like, well, you're eating too much fat, but you still need to eat a certain amount of calories. So like, what do I do? I'll eat more protein. And it's like, we'll talk about it. There's huge problems with doing that, and it will make things worse. So like, if most, and this is known in the research, right? So even the people that they cite for the carnivore diet, like Stephenson, the Arctic explorer, basically he got rabid starvation, which is basically protein intoxication, when he tried to recreate his diet in a hospital setting after he came out of the Arctic. And then the way they fixed it was adding more fat, because if you have too much protein, if you get too much protein in the diet, what winds up happening is you can create a hyperaminoacidemia, hyperammonemia, and basically like you're getting an overproduction of ammonia and too many amino acids, that you're overwhelming the liver's capacity to actually metabolize those things. And it creates an energetic problem directly at the liver, and it creates an overexposure to ammonia, which is toxic, as well as amino acids that become problematic. So the ideal, what the research basically discussed, like, you probably don't want greater than 35% of your calories as protein for your total energy intake. So what does that leave you with? You have that means 65% of your caloric intake has to be fats. And it's like, I don't know what other way you're going to get that fat on this diet, unless it's butter, cream, tallow, something like this, unless you're just eating suet. And like, even if you're going to have bone marrow, it's like, it's still not that far away. It has maybe a minor amount of like different connective tissue components in it, but it's not that far away from just like eating straight up fat. Or even if you're like chewing the fat out of the sections of the ribeye, like there's a reason the fat drippings come out, like it's making the oil because the fat is cooking out. So like, you're gonna have to eat fat, and because you can't eat too much protein, because you'll cause problems at the liver, you'll cause problems with ammonia, and you'll also drive stress. Like one of the things you see in the research is high protein intakes in relation to carbohydrate intakes drive up cortisol levels to help improve the urea cycle, to help improve the clearance of ammonia. It's like, you're going to drive, this diet is like the worst for driving stress. It's just like super high protein, and then fat and carb intake there's zero carbs, and like you have some amount left over for fat. So like, that's even worse. So I don't know what the recommendation would be here in this context, right? Because the context, you're going to be on a carnivore diet. It's like, well, if you're having digestive issues, eat less fat. And it's like, if you're already eating a ridiculous amount of protein, like you probably don't want to push that further. So it's like, stop doing the carnivore diet if you're still having those problems, because it's probably not going to work for you long term.
It would just be a pain to eat that much protein too, if that was all you could eat to get calories. And you'd be full. Like you would get to a point, at least for me, I know I would get to a point where I just couldn't eat any more protein. Like I wouldn't be able to stomach it.
Well, that's why people lose weight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And we talked about that on the weight loss episode, that it has more to do with just like the satiety, right? The satiety from the keto and all the protein and everything.
Yeah, basically the research they showed in these studies that if you overeat protein, what happens is your body starts to drastically slow down gastric emptying and keep you full so that you don't keep overeating the protein. Like they directly mentioned this in the study. It was like a protective way so that you don't, one of the ways the body was kind of trying to protect against like getting too much ammonia, like an excessive amount of ammonia production and like tapping the liver. So yeah, if you just eat a bunch of protein, you're not going to be hungry, and you're going to start losing weight because you're not able to eat enough, plus whatever the burden is on the body to process the ridiculous amounts of protein. I'm pretty sure that Dr. Sean Baker's protein intake is ridiculously high for his diet based on some of the things that he's described, at least when he's doing the carnivore stuff and he's not off carnivore.
The other points I want to touch on is like, with even if you were just eating ribeyes, right, you could still get in like nut butter and olive oil and cream and everything with the added fats, you could still get digestive issues from that alone, right? Because of maybe the more saturated stearic acid type of fat content that tends to give people the runs. So I don't know if you think that that's possible. And like, again, that would just be, you could maybe prevent that from happening by including some fiber sources and other things along with the ribeye.
Number one, even the high protein intake can cause digestive issues for people. So just like massively high protein intake, like rabid starvation, which again is basically protein intoxication or protein toxicity, is characterized eventually by diarrhea. You're dumping protein in the colon, and then the metabolites that are produced in the colon start to irritate the colon and then cause problems. So I think there's that. Also, the bile acids that get released when you have the higher fat intake, those bile acids can really irritate the colon. They basically like have a detergent effect on the lining of the colon, which will cause diarrhea. It'll cause diarrhea. It causes releases of serotonin. It causes negative effects in the microbiome, like all types of issues. And so the high fat will be a problem and the high protein could be a problem in the colon. So it could be both. That's why I'm saying it's kind of a straitjacket. If you're having problems with too high protein intake, like say it's even physiologic problems, then you have to bump up fat. And if you bump up fat and then now you're just getting the straight runs all the time, it's like it's time to consider a different diet because it's like the both things are a huge problem. After 35, you could probably handle, depending on how many calories you were having, potentially more than 35% of calories as protein, but that would probably assume that you would be in a caloric deficit. And then you would still be heavily driving stress. It's arguably worse than running a keto diet. It's just like eating super high protein intake and like not having adequate amounts of fat intake. On a carnivore diet, like you're eating enough protein, depending on how it's set up, that you can run gluconeogenesis, and then that's going to really drive stress because you're going to have to bump up cortisol to drive that gluconeogenesis. And then you have all the problems of like excessive amounts of protein intake, putting pressure on the liver and also potentially the kidneys. So we're trying to find the Goldilocks zone where it's not too much protein that's taxing kidney and liver and creating metabolic issues and stress, but it's not so little protein that you don't have enough for your lean muscle tissue and stuff like this, like you would potentially have on a vegan diet and things along these lines. So there's a balance, and they're both on opposite ends of the spectrum.
And you, with excessive protein intake, don't you drive production of ammonia, right?
Yes, exactly. And that's the ammonia production. The ammonia is toxic. And then cortisol has to raise to increase the urea cycle, to help increase the urea cycle and help with gluconeogenesis to process all of those amino acids. So it directly drives stress through glucagon, through cortisol, all this type of stuff.
And the reason I ask that is because I know for myself, and I've heard from other people who are eating excessive amounts of protein, is that if they start to sweat, their sweat will actually smell like ammonia.
That is possible for some people.
When people are having problems, it's like eventually you just kind of run out of tools, right? Like this person's on a carnivore diet and they're having digestive issues. And now it's like, I cannot eat fats that aren't paired with my ribeye, or like that's the problem. And it's just, you're at the end of the road. And I think the problem is you don't have enough tools and you have to start like assessing whether or not this is the correct dietary path to be on, right?
What are the potential risk versus reward if you're considering this type of diet? A lot of people eating a standard American diet are running into problems, I think largely because a portion of the foods that they're choosing are problematic, like highly problematic. When you go to the carnivore diet, you eliminate those. And I think a lot of people start to feel better in a lot of ways. But now there's new problems that can be created on the carnivore diet. Those problems can easily, the digestive ones at least, will save the hormonal components and stuff for another episode. We kind of touched on them. But if you have a couple things that will get into the colon and will create problems in the microbiome and in the gut, and this is why I think people have a hard time reintroducing foods when they come off their carnivore diet. So as an example, there's a couple things. You have protein, you have bile acids, you have heme iron. These three components, we've touched on these, they are not good to get high amounts of in the colon. So the bile acids in the colon are converted to secondary bile acids. The secondary bile acids are known carcinogens that can irritate the colon and increase permeability of the colon so that you absorb more bacterial toxins, endotoxin from the colon, which we don't want to do. The second thing is the secondary bile acids can create reactive oxygen stress and reactive nitrogen stress at the colonic epithelium and cause damage by causing damage to the mitochondria of the colonocytes, the cells of the colon. So this creates another problem where you're basically you're damaging the mitochondrial function of the cells of the colon, and then you're also causing issues as far as like the colon's permeability. You're making it more permeable. The next thing is bile acids in high amounts, which a high fat diet can increase the production of, particularly a high saturated fat diet, can lead to the overgrowth of certain bacteria like Bilophilia wadsworthia or Allostypes, and the Allostypes putridinensis, but the Allostypes group in general. These bacteria are endotoxin and hydrogen sulfide producing bacteria, and the hydrogen sulfide can further cause a variety of problems, especially in high concentrations, and that includes impairing mitochondrial function. So like that can also directly damage gut function as well. And in different studies, they show that like these animal-based diets, not necessarily like how Paul Saladino describes animal-based, but like a high protein, high fat diet can cause these issues. So that's what we see with the bile acids. Now, the next thing is protein. Only about 95% of protein is absorbed. So you have 5% of protein that actually makes its way into the gut. And so basically the problem with this is that when protein is fermented by the bacteria in the gut, it produces a bunch of toxic metabolites. So you have branched chain fatty acids, you have ammonia, you have hydrogen sulfide, and then you have polyamines, tyramine, tryptamine, phenylethylamine, histamine, putrescine, and cadaverine. These components cause a variety of problematic elements in the gut by stimulating serotonin, by the ammonia directly damaging mitochondrial function, hydrogen sulfide as well, damaging mitochondrial function, and then also the branched chain fatty acids can actually increase the leakiness of the colon and allow for endotoxin to get across the gut. So long-term, bumping up protein fermentation in the gut, even though if there's less waste, is still really not a good idea overall. And then when we get to the heme iron, what we start to see is only 25 to 30% of, they say the iron, they say the absorption of iron has been reported as 25 to 30% in the consumption of organ meats, 7 to 9% in green leafy vegetables, 4% of grains, 2% in dried legumes. So the iron absorption is highest in organ meats, but it's still only 25 to 30%. So you're still getting another 70 to 75% of the heme iron making to the gut. And basically, what they say in the research is that the heme iron can actually cause damage to the gut, cause hyperproliferation of the colonic epithelium, and it predisposes towards colon cancer or colon tumors. And so it's directly irritating the colon. That's basically, it irritates the colon over time, it causes that damage. So you have these three components, which are all induced by this high-fat, carnivore-based diet, particularly set on beef. And so you run into these issues. Now, there's a couple other things that I want to mention really quickly. Those things also change the microbiome so that you have a bunch of endotoxin producing bacteria. So as an example, a bunch of amino acids going into the gut can increase the overgrowth of bacteria, in particularly in Clostridium groups. And you have bacteria, for example, the hydrogen sulfide that are in the Enterobacter group, Salmonella, Klebsiella, Staphylococcus, etc. So these are all, like, I've seen multiple clients whose gut profiles coming off carnivore look absolutely terrible. And a variety of inflammatory markers are bumped up. Their permeability looks terrible as far as zonulin goes. They have a bunch of disulfide Vibrio piger. Bilophilia wadsworthii is bumped up. They have some gram-negative bacterial species are high. And they have a lot of digestive issues. So these are all things that are driven by this diet. So those are the things that you take in from the diet that cause problems. But what are the things that you're removing? If you take out the fiber, you create a variety of problems. One, the fiber produces not branched-chain fatty acids, but short-chain fatty acids like butyrate. Butyrate is used by the colon cells as an energy source. It's like the gasoline for their engines. And so what happens is, if you don't have the butyrate present, you start to create the cells in the colon will start to use other fuel, particularly carbohydrates and things like this coming from potentially from the bloodstream, and then run glycolysis, and then they don't use oxygen. They don't use the oxygen to burn the butyrate, and that leaves more oxygen in the gut. That oxygen in the gut allows for the overgrowth of bacteria that can tolerate oxygen. Those bacteria that tolerate oxygen are generally pathogenic bacteria. You don't want to really have a high amount of oxygen in the gut. So not having fiber and having these other components that I mentioned is like a quadruple whammy on your gut long term. And that's why I think people are like Jordan Peterson, like, man, I had salmon last month and then I had terrible anxiety. It's like, yeah, because you have a microbiome in your colon that really produces tons of polyamines. So when you start having fish that have a decent amount of histidine, which is an amino acid that gets converted to histamine, you get a high histamine level and potentially high polyamines, which can drive serotonin production and drive different neurotransmitters that will create an anxiety response. That's a hypothetical pathway that could be explained by changes inside the gut. Now, the last one I want to talk about here, and I guess it's mostly interesting to me, but I think it'll be pretty helpful for a lot of people. But essentially, inside your gut, you have a mucus lining. And your mucus lining is really important for protecting you from having the bacteria reach the colon. And if the bacteria reach the colon, your immune system goes, oh crap. And it creates a bunch of, especially depending on the type of bacteria, creates an inflammatory stimulus. Basically, in the study, what they show is that if you put animals on a low carbohydrate diet or a low fiber diet, not even low carbohydrate, just low fiber diet, what winds up happening, and I have a picture here so we can show it, what winds up happening is you actually degrade the mucus layer in a really negative way. So on the left-hand side here, what we can see is a mucus layer on a high fiber diet. This green line here is the mucus on the high fiber diet. And you can see it's pretty thick. When you go to the low fiber diet, you can barely see the mucus layer. Like, it's just this little green line over here. And so that means is that the gut intestinal barrier function gets being degraded. Now, why do I think that this occurs? Well, in the research, if you don't have fiber present, the bacteria start feeding on your mucus lining. So they start feeding on your colonic mucus lining, and then that starts to create more problems for you over time. And then on top of that, if you don't have a lot of carbohydrate present, what makes that mucus lining is carbohydrate. So it's like a double effect. I think the very low carbohydrate intake plus, and then the rest of the cells being shifted towards fatty acid oxidation, except the colon cells, which are not oxidizing butyrate because there's not really much being produced. What winds up happening is you deplete that mucus lining, and then now you're in a circumstance where the bacteria start to adhere to the colonic epithelium, and now you have inflammatory signaling, inflammatory stimulus, and that's where people start to get colitis and all this type of stuff, is when the gut and the immune system are saying, hey, like, we're being invaded. Like, there's some, like, the bacteria are trying to get, like, they don't have anything to eat, and they're knocking on the castle door here, and we don't know what to do, and then you start getting the inflammatory response. And so it's like all of these things together can create a recipe for terrible digestive symptoms when trying to come off the carnivore diet. And I think that's what we're seeing with people, is you're solving some problems by cleaning up your diet, getting rid of all the junk, not eating things that are irritating. But then since you don't have fiber, you have heme iron, you have a bunch of bile acids, you have a bunch of protein making it to the colon. And also you don't have the fiber binding up the bile acids to detox the liver. And then you have the endotoxin leak. Your liver and your colon are getting shot from this diet long term. And it's starting to create digestive problems for people. So I wanted to set that stage. I know it's kind of a lot, but it's important because it'll set the stage for when we talk about Jordan Peterson. I know you want
to. I mean, that was just awesome. Like, even to see that on the picture and everything too. Like, that was such a solid case for fiber right there. That's awesome. The natural question that kind of comes after that is like, okay, Mike, what do you think are the best tolerated fiber sources that someone can start to dip their toes in and see their response, like based off anecdotally working with all these people and whatnot?
So it's basically, again, like what we said, is starting with the fruit juices and some of the polyphenolic rich powders. If you use those, or even just doing the fruit juices and then some tolerated fruit sources, berries, maybe bananas, maybe melons, potentially pineapple. Some people may react to the bromelain. Like, I know you react to bromelain. Then you can do squashes, you can do carrots, and then like rice and potatoes. They're not super rich in fiber, but they will have some degree of resistant starches. And even the non-resistant starches, a portion of them will make it to the colon and will serve as substrate for the butyrate producing bacteria. They feed on starch, like some of the Ruminococcus species or Fecalobacterium species. And also, lowering your protein intake is a huge thing. Like, one of the guys I was working with, he was one of my clients coming off carnivore. He's actually a friend now. But he went on carnivore to help deal with one of his autoimmune conditions. And when we first started to work together, he was eating like 3 pounds of steak a day. And then the first thing we did was just lower the steak intake down to a reasonable amount so that he's hitting the target of 0.82 grams per pound per day of protein. And then, and even 0.72 grams per pound per day of protein if you're really having some digestive issues or irritation. We shifted the protein sources a little bit. So it was some steak. He was doing some eggs. He was doing some fish, some seafood options. And then we started to just add in some juices to start that he tolerated. And then we added in a little bit of rice and potato. And then we added in some fruits that he could tolerate. And we also, it took me a while because it kind of fought me on the nutrient repletion stuff with supplements. But when we started to replete the nutrients with supplementation, he started to feel a whole lot better as well. And then he started to tolerate much more things. But it took some time because, again, like we were shifting the microbiome. We were trying to eliminate all that protein being dumped in. And so some of the sources that he tolerated for fibers were like potatoes and carrots up front, and then squashes up front. Those things weren't too big of a deal. And then the fruit sources that a lot of people do tend to do all right with are berries. So those would be the first starting areas I would go to. And then just start to like slowly introduce them and lower that protein intake. And also, this is a huge one. You have to moderate your fat intake when you bump your carb intake up. You can't do 200 grams of fat a day and 400 grams of carbs. Like, it's going to be a recipe for weight gain. You have to figure out your total caloric intake, which, again, I have the nutrition blueprint on my website. It walks through all of this stuff, so I'm not going to go through every single step here. But you figure your total caloric intake, get your protein intake dialed in, and then throttle your carbs and fats based on the caloric intake. Don't just add carbs on top of the fats. You have to add the carbs in and then slowly bring the fats down as you add the carbs in, so that the calories are equated so you don't start gaining weight. Another option that can be helpful is if you're doing tons of saturated fats, and you're getting the runs because you're like, as you asked me about before, Ethan, about the high stearic acid content. If you're getting the runs from all this type of stuff, what you want to then do is maybe shift a little bit towards monounsaturated fats and maybe shift towards whole fat sources like avocado or like some of the egg yolks or potentially mac nuts or something like this, so that you're not getting like a very refined oil source coming in, causing the issues. And then the monounsaturated fat sources actually are relatively neutral in the gut and a little more soothing overall, because they help to minimize the amount of taurine conjugated bile acids that can drive hydrogen sulfide producing bacterial overgrowth, like Bilophilia wadsworthii or Disulfovibrio piger, these species that produce hydrogen sulfide from by using amino acids like taurine or cysteine or something like this. So lower protein, add in the fiber sources I mentioned, slowly start to bring in carbohydrates and do it systematically. Don't just like open the floodgates and like, you know, go ham on everything, because you may get digestive like issues doing that, because your body isn't ready to deal with all of that type of stuff. Again, like your mucus layer is extremely thin when you first come off this diet.
As a side note, from what I've experienced myself and even just joining the community and hopping on group calls and stuff like that, I know orange juice is like the greatest thing in the world, but it seems like some like more people than you would expect don't do as well with orange juice than maybe something like pineapple, grape, pomegranate stuff, right? Is that?
Yeah, the orange juice seems to, especially people who are having histamine issues, seems to be a trigger. Orange juice is a histamine liberator, but it's not really clear from the research that it is a histamine liberator. Like, I couldn't find the studies that directly support that, like showing that with an experiment. But I think some of the polyphenolic compounds in orange juice may be a trigger for people. And then also you may have the polyphenolic compounds can affect liver metabolism, like the phase 1, phase 2 detox pathways. And so you have to be careful, because if you have certain polymorphisms in those pathways, which may have even led you to want to go carnivore in the first place, because you don't detox certain things well, like certain plant compounds or certain components, then the orange juice, you know, depending on what the thing is, depending on what the polyphenol is or what the source is, could modulate things in a way that gives you an issue. But pineapple juice, pomegranate juice, grape juice, white grape juice as well is even more tolerated than purple. But those ones seem to be overall better tolerated for people coming out of the diet. And as you, over time, depending on what the issue is, as you start to improve, your digestion starts to improve, you start to tolerate potentially more things. Well, you may still not tolerate certain things. They may still be an issue for you.
Also, the strategies we talked about earlier with maybe cutting the juices and adding in fruit extract powders as like another boost. And then the next thing you mentioned after that was the micronutrient replenishing. After that, you can maybe fiber. So berries, carrots, squash, melon, pineapple, be careful with the bromelain, and maybe green beans to start with.
Yeah, and then like potatoes and rice, if you do
potatoes,
well,
rice, gotcha. And then the last thing to do also as well is moderate total fat intake. And you can get those numbers for the amounts of proteins, fat, and carbohydrates. You can check out the nutrition blueprint link below if you want to see that. And then maybe switch fat sources to more monounsaturated fats because of the bile acid situation. And maybe even go towards more whole fat sources like avocado, macadamia nuts, chocolate, and things like this.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. All right, perfect. I think that will be a good four-step timeline for people to try out. So let's jump into the last one here, the granddaddy of them all, Jordan Peterson. He was the one who kind of convinced me to do the carnivore. I mean, we didn't speak personally, but I was watching his content. we'll jump into him. But yeah, I think a lot of people kind of heard the story from Michaela, his daughter, Michaela Peterson, and Jordan Peterson on Joe Rogan. And that kind of led them to try out the carnivore diet. And then since then, Dr. Peterson's done the media rounds and been somewhat advocating for the carnivore diet with different people such as Elon Musk. And then as we talked about before, carnivore is touted as like the ultimate elimination diet. And I think there are some maybe problems with that we discussed earlier. But
if you are suffering from chronic health conditions, especially if you're also overweight, an elimination diet is worth trying on the off chance that something you're eating is causing your symptoms, because who knows? And the simplest elimination diet is obviously just beef.
Yeah.
Right? So why not go down to one variable? And if it doesn't work, like we've talked to many people, and I know people say, well, anecdotes aren't data. It's like, no, but they're hypotheses.
Yeah.
And many of the same anecdotes start to look a lot like data. So anyways, we've talked to many people who've reported remission of their diabetic or arthritic symptoms within 2 weeks of an only beef diet. And so we are thinking that it's more like 3 months is a good trial. And if it doesn't work, well, okay. The loss is some restriction for 3 months, and that's about it. And it's not like it's easy. I'm not saying that. And you may suffer some complications in the transition to the new and more restrictive diet, but you can live on just beef. So like, what the hell, if you're half dead and radically overweight.
Okay. So the first thing is, I agree with like the first point. If you are suffering with chronic health conditions, focusing in on diet as the first step, I think is absolutely essential, like absolutely extremely important. And I see that like people do not do this. They go, I got to go hormones. I'm going to go supplements. I'm going to go like $10,000 worth of testing, like things like this. And it's like, look at your diet, just throw it in chronometer, see what you're doing. Like, I can't tell you how many calls I do. It's like, I didn't know I was eating 200 grams of fat a day. No wonder I can't lose weight. And it's like, there's things like this that are like low hanging fruit that can make a massive difference to how you're feeling, how you're functioning, your energy levels, your digestion, if your diet isn't dialed in. And that this is why, like, even with the course I built out and all this type of stuff, it's centered primarily for the first step on diet, because it's the number one most important thing to get down pat first. I know that Jack Cruz says it's light, but I completely disagree that is the number one thing, and diet is number six. Diet is extremely important for a lot of people, and I wouldn't even rank them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But like, if you're going to start somewhere, you have a lot of agency with diet, and it can make huge differences right off the bat, how you feel, how you function, with how you're fueling yourself. So I think going and trying to figure out an elimination diet is actually really helpful, and something I do with many clients. Just doing only beef just because it's the simplest, I don't think means that it's the best. And as we just talked about, it creates a variety of new concerns and new issues that we would have to look at if it's just beef, but from a hormonal perspective, but also from a gut perspective, as I laid out in detail, that I would say, like, well, maybe you don't need to go all the way down to just beef. Maybe you can still have some carbohydrate. Maybe you could still keep some certain fiber sources in your diet and start there, and then start to expand out, so you don't create new issues that you then have to solve later on. And so just because beef is the simplest one variable thing doesn't mean it's the best thing to go down to. And also doesn't mean it's necessary to have to go down to just one variable for your diet to have the elimination diet. With a lot of my clients, they have more than one variable, because you can sit down with somebody, look in chronometer and say, hey, you know, do you do well with this? Yeah, I do pretty good with this. Do you do well with that? Yeah, I do okay with that. Do you well with that? Yeah, I do okay with that. All right, let's use these things that you've been using that you do relatively okay with for your current set of the diet. Set that up, run that for 2 weeks, see how you feel, and then start to make adjustments based on the feedback we get, instead of saying, hey, let's go all the way down to just beef, and then to get stuck at just beef for the next 3 years and then be like, well, I don't know how to transition out of this diet. Like, I think that because you create new problems when you do that diet. And that's where I think Jordan Peterson is, and also potentially where Michaela Peterson is. And they're actually starting to talk about some of this stuff. And Jordan talks about it here.
For somebody who doesn't necessarily have an idea of what they tolerate and don't tolerate, what do you suggest for them? Like, you're looking at the chronometer, like, I don't really know if I'm doing well with this or not, because maybe they do have a lot of variables in their diet. So do you strip it down to, I think when most people think of an elimination diet, the last thing they would consider pairing like the beef with is like, oh, pineapple juice, you know? So, I mean, but that maybe isn't the worst option, right? You know? So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
One, you have the nutrition blueprint on the website, which has a food guide with it, plus the calculations to help you figure out your calories and your macros for maintenance, not for like deficit or bulking, whatever your goal is, just to figure out like where you need to be to maintain your weight. And so, and there's also food sources there. So I'd recommend checking that out, because like, it's like you could print it out, like all the stuff is right there. But essentially, you're going to want to look for a protein source, animal protein source, beef, chicken, fish, which any of those you tolerate. Dairy could be hit or miss, so maybe hold that in the beginning. Then carb sources, figure out what you do well with. Is it starch? Is it sugar? Is it fruits? Is it juices? Is it rice? Is it potatoes? Is it some combination of those? Maybe it's oats. Maybe you do fine with oats. Like, just some of those things. And then after that, then you need to figure out your fiber source. Is it going to be the fruits? Is it going to be some of the starch sources? Do you do some cooked veg, some cooked carrot, some cooked squash? Just like these very basic things. They don't have a lot of FODMAPs. They don't have like super irritating fibers. A lot of people tend to do well with them. They're pretty benign for most. They don't have a lot of potentially irritating plant compounds or toxic components like goitrogens, things like this. You start there. And then after that, you have your fat sources. Is it going to be olive oil? Is it going to be, maybe you do okay with beef fat. Maybe you have fatty steaks. Is it going to be dairy fat? Maybe you do okay with dairy fat. Maybe it's mac nuts. Maybe it's avocados. These types of things are all great options to start with. The avocados may have some FODMAP, but in general, a lot of people tend to tolerate these things okay. And then I would start there with those sources, so that you have a protein, a carb, a fat, and a fiber in each meal, 3 or 4 meals a day. And then you run from there. And then you can start to systematically test one thing out at a time, instead of getting all the way down to beef, then when you try to reintroduce something, you have a bad response, and then you don't know why, and then you stay at beef, and you try and you stay at beef, and you try and you stay at beef, because you're not, because again, the beef is just the carnivore setup. It's not beef is problematic, but the whole setup can create certain problems. So I think beef is fine to incorporate in the diet. I'm not anti-beef. I eat it all the time. Many people I work with eat it all the time. It's just only beef by itself as your only food source creates unique problems because of what goes on in the GI tract and what, because of the lack of certain things in the diet, not necessarily because beef by itself is just a problem. So I would get to that as a starting point and then test things out kind of systematically and go from there. So it's a great idea if you have chronic health conditions to try the elimination diet. But I think going down to just beef, even because it's the simplest, can actually create some new problems for people, and they may still solve their issues even if they don't go down to only just beef.
I think the best with an elimination, so say when you're saying test things out systematically, like let's say someone decides, okay, the foods I'm going to start with, pineapple juice, white rice, some chicken, some fish. I don't want to touch the red meat right now. And for my fat source, I'm going to do olive oil. Now I'm okay with all those things. I've run them for this particular amount of time. Is there a particular amount of time that you suggest before someone adds in a new food? What is the protocol like there?
I would just give the person like one to two weeks on the setup with the diet, see how you run it, like, and use the foods that you already are doing decently well with. And then from there, and then within the categories that you recommended, and then start trying to add foods or play with the foods that you're currently eating if you are still running into some issues. And then do it, test out those foods individually. I do like a 3 or 4 day time frame. The only other things for the last three points, I don't think you need 3 months to see a change in something with diet. I think like a couple weeks, you'll know if you're starting to feel better and things are starting to change. And also, this is not to gaslight people who actually got benefits and health improvements on carnivore or low carb, because like it happens. It's legit. Like it legit occurs. So we're not saying it doesn't. We're just talking about some of the potential pitfalls and put some of the potential workarounds, because people also have gotten pretty significant changes in their health following diets that weren't just steak. So the question is like, what is the specific problems? And then how are we going to solve those? And so, yeah, let's jump into the next clip here.
And this contradicts to some degree something I said earlier, you know, that you could reduce to a carnivore diet and then add back. It's very complicated to add back. Right? You really have to think like a scientist and you have to be very disciplined, you know, to experiment with one thing at a time in addition. And then also to figure out, well, how do you know if it's helping? Like, what's your measure and over what time frame? You know, so like I've tried to add things back to I added salmon back to my diet. And it turned out that it made me anxious and I have no idea why. And it's a pretty robust effect. And it took a fair while to manifest itself. And so you have these terrible complex problems with adding things back, which is, well, maybe if you added phytonutrients, for example, of the sort that you were describing, it would take a month to see a difference. And it would be hard to measure except in certain circumstances. So like, how do you know? And that's the problem with any scientific investigation. And the advantage to just eating beef is that it's really... It's simple, right? It's like, no, just do this. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if there would be ways of, it might surprise me, but I could imagine that there would be ways of improving your diet beyond what you would get with merely meat. But man, it's a conundrum to figure out how to go about doing that.
So this is exactly what we were talking about. The first question that Jordan asked for the first clip is like, if it doesn't work, like you just risk some restriction. It's like, no, if it doesn't work after the 3 month time frame, and then you run into new problems, and then now you're stuck on the diet, like that is a risk. And now you're just stuck on this carnivore diet because you can't tolerate these different foods. And I think a lot of people are hitting that spot. And you know, I hit that spot for a period of time. Like I got down to just the beef and the steak, the beef and the tallow, and I was like, man, like I have no idea what my next step is. I do not know what to eat, because every single thing I put in my mouth is a problem besides the steak and the fat. And even the steak and the fat is a problem right now. Like I'm running to the bathroom and I'm having tons of irritation. Other people are having other issues as well, like insomnia, anxiety, constipation, cold hands, cold feet. I had one client who's like, she's like, I was literally getting on the carnivore diet, like black dots on my toes from the vasoconstriction that I was having on the carnivore diet. So things like this, like it solved some things for her, but it made other things worse. So this is a risk of the carnivore diet. And I think that's why I say you don't need to go all the way down to absolutely just steak. And it's also why we talked about, like, why is Jordan Peterson having this experience where he can't even eat a piece of salmon without getting anxiety? And it's because, I think, of what's going on inside the gut with the diet. I think he's in a circumstance where his microbiome, the gut function, all this type of stuff, perhaps liver function, is impaired because he doesn't have the fiber. He's dumping heme iron. He's dumping potentially set bile acids. He's dumping protein in the colon. He doesn't have the fiber to bind up the bile acids to pull out toxins from the liver. So now some of his pathways are overloaded as far as detox. And then his ability to metabolize certain things in the colon are problematic. Maybe he has a bunch of histamine producing or polyamine producing bacteria inside the gut because he's feeding them mostly meat, which will select for those, which will then lead to an overproduction of things like histamine, putrescine, tyramine, things like this that can change neurotransmitters and give you anxiety or fast heart rate or some of them hypertension. You have to be careful, things like tyramine. So these are, I think it's, that's why he's in this circumstance, is because of these specific problems. And then on top of that, the carnivore diet has some issues depending on how it's set up with nutrient density. So maybe he's iron overloaded as well. Maybe he's running a copper deficiency because he doesn't incorporate any organ meats in the diet. Maybe he has electrolyte issues because he's not eating any carbohydrates. Plus, he has a poor sodium to potassium balance, and then maybe a poor calcium to phosphorus balance. Plus, potentially certain B vitamins may be missing, like folate. And maybe he has MTHFR mutations or things like this. So all of these things can create problems by themselves from this diet, even though carnivore initially solves some of them. And then if you run it for a while, you can start to dig into those pathways and dig into those problems. And then now you can't add anything back into the diet. So you have to digest the stuff we talked about, allowing oxygen to get into the gut because there's no short chain fatty acids and colonic metabolism's off from the lack of fiber. You have the protein metabolites, the bile acids, the heme iron irritating the colon, the lack of the mucus layer, lack of bile acids pulling out or lack of fiber pulling out the bile acids from the colon so the detox pathways can get overloaded in the liver. And then you also have the whole hormonal state. If your calcium to phosphorus ratio is off, parathyroid hormone's bumped. If you are eating no carbohydrates and really high protein, you're probably going to have low T3 values and thyroid hormone is going to be crashed. Maybe your sex hormone binding globulin levels are going to be through the roof, so you're not going to have adequate amounts of testosterone and things and sex steroids. Maybe cortisol to DHEAS ratios are going to be destroyed, so you're going to be under stress because you have so much protein intake, no carbohydrate intake. And then maybe you're going to have altered values for gluconeogenesis, bumped ALT, bumped AST, bumped glucagon levels because you have so much protein intake and it's tapping the liver. So all of these things altogether, I think, are creating a perfect storm where it's like, well, I can't add anything in. It's like you're going to have to add things in to get out of this hole. It's just not going to be like a really fun transition when you're adding some of these components in because so many things could have gone awry depending on your specific predisposition and what's going on with the diet. And that's why, like, there is a risk to just going down to beef, even though it's the easiest, most simplest thing, because it's just one variable. It's like you can create new problems. And that's why I think it's important to understand what is your risk and versus reward when you embark on a particular experiment, dietarily, supplementarily, et cetera, and know, like, okay, is this risk worth that reward? And can I get the benefit without having to do this super extreme thing? And again, like, I was super gung-ho about carnivore at one point, but I backed off of it after I had a really terrible time on it. And it's like, well, why am I having a terrible time? And how can I mitigate this? And I think these are some of the ways that we talked about to mitigate that and avoid people going into this being like, well, now I can only eat beef, and also avoid people or help people who are in that state and say, like, well, how can I transition out of this? And that was the point of the whole podcast.
I think it's just a really tough spot to be in for someone like Jordan Peterson or anybody else who's kind of run into this issue now where they can't really tolerate foods without having some problematic symptoms. So, I mean, we tried in the podcast, right, to give some of the best strategies to, like, reintroduce things and implement stuff in a stepwise fashion versus going full bore into the carbohydrates and everything like we see a lot of people do. So I encourage everyone to maybe try some of the things we talked about in here. This was a really interesting podcast for me to do just because of how invested I am into this topic. So I don't know if there's anything you want to say before we hop off.
Yeah, I'm going to make a YouTube video going through, like, the specific mechanisms and studies that I discussed with the research behind it, and also, like, lay out the steps for a potential, like, recovery out of the carnivore hole for people. So stay tuned for that. And then with that, you know, if anybody wants to find me, they can find me here on the Mike Fave YouTube, or they can find me at my website, mikefave.com. And then what about you, Ethan? Where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Ethan_Wright. That's where I'll be. And then obviously you'll find me here every single week doing the podcast with Mike. So we will catch you next week.
Yep, catch everybody next week.
All right.